Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Forrest Stevens Show. In today's episode, I'm talking with guest Chris Neubauer, who is an author and a neuropsychology PhD. So we talk about the left and right brain a lot and the kind of baked in DNA that we have to have a thinking mind, intrusive thoughts. We get into a lot of very fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed talking with Chris about everything that he knows and wants to share about. So this will be a good one, and I hope you enjoy. Here it is.
So it's great to be here. I started off wanting to be a musician. That was my great love. I wanted to be an 80s guitarist. Still very much enjoy music it's turned into something quite sacred in my life. And one of the main go-tos in my philosophy, when I kind of expand on that a little bit, I have it focused around our obsession with thinking and how much peace and joy we feel when we get out of the thinking mind. And people ask me all the time, well, okay, that sounds great. How do you do it? And my go-to is music. And it's one of the easiest ways to do it. It's one of the ways that we're all doing it already, which makes it nice. So, in my early 20s, my dad died unexpectedly, and it threw me into a neurosis. It was really bad. I was so neurotic that, like, even having a conversation with you, I would just have the monkey mind would be like, "You're going to die any second." So it was pretty it occupied almost all of my day. And of course, that's why I went into psychology. I thought, well, there's got to be some way to work on this, because this is ridiculous. And psychology did help, but I was so fortunate. I really don't remember how I ran into Alan Watts, how I stumbled onto his work. Somehow I stumbled onto his work. Maybe the universe kind of sent me a couple cues here and there. And once I started reading Alan, I found how much was missing in psychology, and really completed the picture for me and filled in so many blanks. And so much of what I was doing was trying to undo my problems. And I discovered, it was maybe one of the most powerful epiphanies, that my anxiety was me not wanting to be anxious. Like, that was my anxiety. So I was just listening to Alan, just, you know, maybe it was an hour ago, and he said, you know, the thing that really holds us back with self-improvement is our incredible, overwhelming desire to self-improve. It just all fit. It's like it was me trying not to be anxious that was causing all the anxiety. And this often gets described in people's experiences as surrender. And once I had that moment of surrender, I was like, this was a huge aha moment for me. I was like, and I went back to all the intro books, because at that point, you know, I'd been taking some psych classes and they didn't talk about it at all. And I was like, this is so important, but you don't find it in a single introductory or even some of the more advanced psych books. So I ended up getting a doctorate in left-right brain differences. And was kind of cruising along pretty smoothly in an academic career. And then a lot of the universities became a little bit more focused on the left brain. And they became kind of examples of how the left brain functions. And unfortunately, I'm a far right brain person. And so I was sort of out of my element. And so I started writing books, talking mostly about our overdependence on left brain processing, and some real practical ways to get out of that. Because, you know, we could spend a lot of time with philosophy, and I have a deep love for philosophy, but it also, in some ways, can reflect the kind of overthinking of the left brain. So when I wrote these books, I always wanted to have it very practical. That's why if you read anything like No Self, No Problem, it has so many exercises in it, because that's where we change. That's where we really, it's all experiential. You can't think your way out of any of this. It has to be experiential. And so I left academia a few years ago to really focus on writing. And it's been a wild, amazing adventure. Just the people I meet, and just to get to know all these different people, and like yourself, just to have these conversations. And So I'm working on, so I've got the No Self, No Problem. I have the workbook on it, and now I'm going to have something come out, I hope, next year. And it's all kind of building on getting us out of thinking. And the self is just one version of it. And it turns out when you really explore the modern world that we're living in, there's so many abstractions in our lives, from work, government, money, ownership. And I just keep going through this list of these, you know, amazing thinking constructs that make up so much of our lives. And then getting out of all that and just coming back to simple, what I call clear consciousness, but just consciousness without thinking. And those moments are those beautiful moments that just fill our lives with joy. That's where meaning is. That's where it's all at.
So there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I wanted to just clarify a few things, get a couple definitions from you. So you mentioned your thinking mind and working on that. What does that mean? What is a thinking mind?
It's great. Great question. Great place to start. Awesome place. Because although I did left-right brain differences, my technical degree is in cognitive psychology. And so, okay, what's cognition? Well, that's just a fancy word for thinking. And so you go back to 1967. There was a cognitive revolution in psychology. Up until then, they just, thoughts weren't really very important. And we had things like behaviorism, where we were focusing on like controlling the environment and seeing how we would respond. You know, if you wanted to change yourself, you'd just punish yourself. You know, if you wanted to quit smoking, you'd just shock yourself after you have a cigarette. And so all of a sudden, the cognitive revolution happened. And we're in that now. And you can see that because if you go into therapy, the most popular form of therapy now is cognitive therapy. And so they start focusing on your thinking. And so it was discovered that a lot of us have a thinking problem. But again, this goes back to 1967. And Neisser, who's a real popular psychologist, who really formed this cognitive discipline, he defined cognitions as any sensory process that is transformed, elaborated, reduced, and then stored, and then used in the future. Now, the really important thing about that definition, so our thoughts are, it comes from sensory processes, but the most critical part of that is thoughts are sensory processes, see here, but they're transformed. We elaborate them, we reduce them. So we're not seeing, our thoughts are not mere images of reality. They're transformed. Some things get reduced, some things get elaborated. And so it was a beautiful insight that I still think we're working on, because there's in philosophy, they call it naive realism, which is all your thoughts are perfect reflections of the world. The main transformative insight with the cognitive revolution is that our thoughts are these transformed versions of reality. So it was almost like the Matrix in a sense, like you're not living in reality. Your thoughts are these, you know, transformed, manipulated images of the real world. And of course, that was a very important insight for therapy, because they discovered that, of course, all of our thoughts are not accurate. And some of them can be wildly transformed. And so, you know, an anorexic may look in the mirror and see themselves as overweight. And our thoughts, so someone with OCD, their thoughts are just maybe not be realistic in the sense that, you know, there's not going to be germs everywhere that are going to, you know, kill you or get you sick all the time. So that's how the therapy came to be. Was to realize, look, our thoughts are not even, and you can say, well, some thoughts are closer, but we never hit that mark of a perfect thought that reflects genuine reality. If we look in the history of humans, we've got so many kind of blows to our ego, you know, with Darwin, you're just, you know, a fancy ape. And then Freud came along and everything's controlled by your unconscious. And I think this was another a grand blow to the human ego, that your thoughts, you're not seeing reality as it is. You're seeing this, your version of reality.
Right. That's what I was going to say there, was that it's like the perception of the individual, and there's so much that makes up, like, you know, you and I could be standing in the same room experiencing the same thing and having a completely different experience just because of who we are or how we think, or basically our perception. So I guess with that, like, so that is a pretty big realization about the way we experience the world and about reality in general, the human existence. But what can we do with that? Where does that go? Where does that realization, how do we expand on that? You said it's kind of like the moment with Darwin, with what he brought to the table, and Freud. You know, how is it this next big step, and what have we learned from this realization?
So we can take thought apart a little bit, and so what's happening when we're thinking? And for most people, thoughts, and you can have pictures in the mind, but for most people, especially problematic thoughts, because when it comes to thinking, thoughts, a lot of them are harmless, but it's the intrusive thoughts that I notice really catch people's attention. You know, if I do a YouTube video, so I have a channel on YouTube, and if I do a YouTube video on intrusive thoughts, people just, it's always one of the more watched videos, because it's these intrusive thoughts, of course, that keep us up at night. You know, maybe we're, you know, a really good athlete, we can make this shot in our sleep, but now the game depends on me making the shot, and all of a sudden I've got all these intrusive thoughts and I miss because, you know, I just froze or choked, as they call it in psychology and sports. And so one of the things, when we look at what's happening when we're thinking, and in particular when we have these intrusive thoughts, it's almost always as a voice in the head. So we have this inner voice. And there's a lot of very interesting things about the inner voice. Because, well, just to go back a little bit, and maybe we'll get into this about the left-right brain, but one of the main differences about the left and right sides of the brain is attention. So the left brain has a very narrow, like a tight spotlight of attention. It can only focus on one thing at a time. Now, that's interesting because also the left brain does language, which is one word at a time. And so everything that goes on in your brain, it's very sequential. It's very one word, one thought at a time. And I would ask people, well, let's test this. Like, can you have three thoughts at a time? And people would struggle with that. Like, can you even have two thoughts at a time? And it was quickly recognized, okay, you could have one thought. So when we're thinking and having these intrusive thoughts, it points to what the left brain is up to. It seems like they're coming from this left brain. And in fact, some of the research even suggests a greater left brain activity with these intrusive thoughts. Okay, so that tells us a little bit about what's happening when we're thinking. What about the right brain? Well, the right brain's attention is far more vast. It's far more big picture. So, you know, maybe people have heard, well, the right brain gets the big picture. And that actually does turn out to be true in terms of the research. So it can pay attention to many things simultaneously. And of course, that's what happens with music. When you think about, when you're listening to music, it's like, you know, there's drums and guitar and all these, and it's all coming together. So the right brain is much better at that. And the left brain would be lost if it had to attend to all those things at once. So when we talk about thinking, the first thing is it's the result of a very limited attention of the left brain using language. But the other thing about this system is to recognize that it's an old evolutionary system. So we probably, it's a very controversial thing. When did humans start speaking? In fact, there are some groups that have forbidden that conversation because it's so controversial. But it could, I'm just giving rough guesses, maybe 50,000 years ago, at some point. I mean, Homo sapiens, we're about 300,000 years old on the planet. And at some point, we started doing what we're doing right now, you know, using these symbols to represent things in the world. And so it's a very new thing. And so this whole process of thinking, it's so easy to grow up in a culture that is obsessed with thinking and just assume that this has been the human condition the whole time. But it isn't. Thinking is very new. And we do all know this because the first 2 years of our lives were spent in this kind of joyful meditative state of seeing reality far closer to how it is before we started thinking about it and talking about it.
I just had a quick question there. Are you kind of saying that like we didn't have thinking as we know it now or as we're talking about it now before language?
Yes. And that's a very controversial in the literature. You've got many people who say that you can think without language. And I don't like to talk in absolutes. I would suggest that there probably was some forms of thinking. And so like one very clever form of thinking, and I always use this example because our poor dog, if we take him out for a walk, he'll get his leash caught around a mailbox post because he can't figure it out. He keeps struggling, thinking like if he just tries harder, he'll get out. But the trick, and the human mind is very good at this, the thinking mind, you just back up and you get out of the problem. And so it's not always language. There are some kinds of the thinking mind can solve problems, and some of it's not necessarily language-based. But it does seem like the majority of what we call thinking, and there is actually research on this that looks at, in particular, intrusive thoughts, the majority of the thinking that causes us problems tends to be language-based, and it's the voice in the head. And the last thing, I'm sure we'll have go come back to this, but this is a very old program. So maybe it started 50,000 years ago. It evolved in a world where there's like, you know, glaciers outside. You know, we were hunter-gatherers. We didn't even have, like, I mean, think agriculture is like 12,000 years ago. So we didn't even start doing farming and having stable homes until like, just a really short time ago. And so this problem-solving mechanism that talks mostly evolved in a world that is so radically different for us that we have a hard time to even imagine it. I mean, look, everything that you look at, we all have homes, cars and technology. And to think that you are just naked in the woods and you this is life for you. And you're going to wander about, you're going to gather your food as you go along, small groups of people, 50, maybe 150 at the most. And of course, you knew all of them. You know, everyone in the tribe was known. This is a limit. I think it's called Dunbar's limit. He was the anthropologist who came up with it. And so that's why even now, today, that's about the biggest amount of people we can know. So you might have 5,000 friends on social media, but in terms of realistic terms of how many friends and people you can really know, it's limited because of our past. But the thing I was going to mention about thinking, and this is another one for your listeners to try out for yourself. And I used to have my students do this. And I would say, okay, well, remember, this is just a generic device, this internal dialogue with the East. They call it the monkey mind. But it's just there to get you to survive. So it's going to be wrong a lot. Test it for yourself. And we used to keep journals. I would say, particularly the intrusive thoughts. So if you have pleasant thoughts, you know, if they're not doing anything, let them be. But these intrusive thoughts, like, I have a flight tomorrow, it's going to crash. Write these things down and then give a confidence rating. How certain am I that this is going to, I'm going to get fired tomorrow? That email I sent, I know my boss is going to be so mad and my boss is going to be furious and call me into the office. HR is going to, and write all that down. And then test to see how many of these come true. And when I did this, I did it every semester, for the last couple of years, the highest accuracy rating one student had was 50% of the time. Most people, it was lower than that. It was like 20, 10. One student was so frustrated because they were like, my mind is never right. It wasn't right about any of it. And then you start seeing these wonderful, the people in the East were aware of this far earlier than us Western scientists. They knew about what they called the monkey mind. They knew the mind was wrong far more than it was right. And they knew it wasn't who we are. They knew that trying to control the mind was so silly. The more you try to control it, the more you think it's you. And you know, if you just have this autonomous program that was like a survival mechanism, let it do its thing, you know? And so I don't, this idea that, and some therapists, they'll try to do thought stopping. And that's, you know, a tough one, because if I say, don't think of the number 13, of course, the mind just starts thinking of 13. And this all came from my own experiences. The more I tried to calm down and not be anxious, the more anxious I got. When I gave up on all of it, suddenly the anxiety went away. And that's the way the mind works. The mind has this strange quality to it, where when we leave it alone, and of course we learned this from so many Eastern philosophies, when you know you leave water alone, it becomes clear, everything settles. And if you're constantly trying to stir it, trying to get it to be clear, it just becomes very muddy, and life becomes difficult, because it's like this, you know, you're trying to see the world through muddy water, and that could be very difficult.
A couple of things you've said there have made me think about this idea of there sort of being, like you mentioned, sort of the survival, and it almost makes sense if we look back on our history of as a species, that like if we can have memories, if we can live with some sense of fear of certain things, I mean that's going to improve our survival rate as an individual. So you know, it's probably good to have fear that, you know, this saber-toothed tiger is going to attack you or whatever, right? But it's almost like we've advanced or in a lot of ways, but we still have that underlying part of our DNA that has that fear base. And we now live in kind of a modern society where our lives are, and I'm speaking very general here, but we don't necessarily need to be afraid of for our survival day to day, but we still have that, and it kind of plays out as intrusive thoughts. Is that sort of summing up part of what you were saying there? If you've been enjoying this podcast for a while, I know that you're going to enjoy this next thing that I'm talking about, which is my book. It's called Tripping. And this book and the podcast are definitely interconnected. And sometimes in this podcast, on the solo episodes, I'll actually just open up this book to a random page, read it out, and talk about what it kind of brings to mind or how it was formulated and thought out. These pages aren't full, so this can be kind of a journal type thing where my paragraph in here is a jumping off point. It's a new thought, and it will spark creativity within your own mind, and you can add to it in your own way. Now, that's what I do on the podcast sometimes. And a little bit about this book. It is available on Amazon as a paperback. I highly recommend it as a paperback, as that trip companion, as that journal. And you can just randomly flip to it, or you can read it through and kind of just gain some insights and some nice jumping off points for yourself. But this book was written over a year of my life, a life in isolation and doing intense yoga every single day for over an hour, breath work, and combining that with different psychedelics, predominantly cannabis, and writing down the thoughts that came to my mind. Then I filtered through those thoughts and those writings and edited them up a little bit so that they were concise and that they would create a new thought in your mind. That's the goal of this book. And I hope that it will be interesting. And so far, a lot of people who have bought it have said that it's been really, really awesome. So, I mean, that's that's good for them. And I think if you enjoy this podcast, like I said, just to wrap it all up, if you enjoy this podcast, you will definitely enjoy this book. It's available in the description below. Recommend getting the paperback. It is available on Kindle as well. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, there was never a moment. It's like the appendix or something. We just don't need it anymore. And, you know, but it's still there. And of course, the appendix doesn't really cause us many problems, but the thinking mind does. And I would put it exactly like you said. You know, it has a tendency to be paranoid because in the past that was what survived. But and as evolutionary psychologists tell us, all these survival tools were to get our DNA to survive, not to make us happy. So but that's what we want now. So we're at this wonderful place, much of the world is, where we're simply not. I mean, I don't worry about survival. You know, I've got that. You know, I've got this house that's going to, protect me. And so, what does the monkey mind do anymore? I mean, it's just it used to be very useful. Now all of a sudden, it's been okay. You know, what can I do? And so it creates a lot of problems. One of my favorite studies, and I like to mention it as much as I can, and I still need to look at, they gave it a very fancy title, which I think that's the reason most of us can't remember it. But we just call it the blue dot experiment. Did you ever hear this one? So it's a very interesting task where all you have to do is hit a key every time a blue dot comes on the screen. And of course, there's all these purple dots and different colored dots. And that's what subjects did, super easy. But then they removed all the blue dots. And of course, you think, okay, the problem's gone. You should stop responding. But that's not what they did. It was a resetting of the goalpost. They changed what a blue dot was. Now it was a purple dot. So if they saw purple, then now they'd hit a key. And they did this in a couple interesting ways. So in another study, it was, hit this key every time you see an angry face. And they did that. And there were other kinds of emotions. But then they took the angry faces out of the equation. Again, people should have stopped responding. Problem gone. But that's not what the mind did. It reset what an angry face is. And so that's what, so that program, that's a very, it illustrates the nature of that program. It's like, okay, I don't have a bear chasing me. I've got food. But now the air conditioner isn't exactly where I want it. Now my car doesn't go as fast as I would like. Now other people make more at work than me. And it's usually some trivial, it's like, fractions of a fraction of something. But and again, this is not to any way be judgmental about this program. It's just doing what it was meant to do. But we look at it as, this endless pursuit of happiness, and we can't figure out why does everything keep resetting? And I've got the job, I make more money. If 10 years ago, if I made this money, I would have been. But then I'm still not happy. It's an identification problem, because this machine for survival, you think that's you, and so we think that's me. So we say I'm not happy. It's not you that isn't happy. It's this machine, and I put it in the left brain, that this keeps resetting the goals every time you achieve them. And so in my work, and of course that's the no self, no problem, the whole theme behind it, is that we're not who we think we are. And most of our problems stem from an identification problem. We think we're this program. And we say things like, I'm unhappy, rather than saying, there's this survival machine in my left brain and it was pretty miserable today. Well, that's a pretty harmless thing to say. Much better to say that than I'm unhappy, because then there's a you, and there's a whole identification with those lines, and it's a bigger problem. If I'm unhappy, that's huge. If there's this leftover neuromachinery from 50,000 years ago that hasn't been updated, so it's just complaining. That's not a very big problem, In fact, I've watched my left brain complain about silly. Oh, I just had a great one a couple of days, and I couldn't help. I was just laughing because I'm just like, it was so funny. It was some. I think maybe the food was a little too cold or something. One of these like really trivial things that you just catch yourself and you start laughing, and that's one of the fundamental themes of my work, is to help people stop the confusion with identification and recognize that this left brain program is just doing its work. It's always going to find a problem. It's always going to. So you say, when am I not going to have problems? Well, you don't have any problems right now at all. And this is when you see the shift in awareness from identifying with this problem-seeking left brain survival mechanism to consciousness. you know, tasting your tea in the morning, feeling the sun on your face, these simple, clear conscious experiences without thinking, there's never a problem in that state. There are no problems. There's no you. There's no identity. And those are just these beautiful experiences that when you get that going and look back at the silliness of some of those left brain workings, it's, I don't know. I just, it can be very funny. And I was just to maybe put that in light of one of Alan Watts' quotes is that enlightenment is to the transformation of anxiety into laughter.
I love that. That's great. Yeah, there's a couple things there. I mean, you mentioned this this sort of we rise to the level that we're at, and we what I think is that as humans we're very adaptable, so we adapt super easy into the situation that we're in, and we think that like what we're doing is sort of the new normal. So if the example you said is, you know, you make more money, it's like you make more money, that's just your new normal. You can adapt to that super, super easily. And then that problem no longer exists, but your problem part is searching for that and trying to find the next problem to solve. It's like, and it doesn't solve the problem. It's kind of up to you or like a different part of you maybe to solve that problem, but it's like searching for it. Yeah, it's just, it's incredibly interesting. And I think you're right on there with the identification with that, as being an issue. And there's people out there who don't even recognize that that's maybe a different piece of who they are, you know, like the way I look at it is like that identification or that part of me, that baked in DNA survival part, that's a part of me, but it isn't who I am. So I still need to acknowledge it as something legitimate, as something that comes up. And there's these practices, like there's meditation practices of just being aware of your thoughts, not trying to stop them or not trying to not have this part of you that thinks anymore, but just when you have a thought, just say, okay, you know, thank you. I acknowledge that I've had this thought and I'm just going to let it go. And then just the next one, right? So it's like, there's people that aren't even aware that they have this part of them. And then therefore it can kind of run a lot more of their life. There's people who are aware of it, but not aware that there's a way to deal with it. Or, you know, there's different stages and there's just a lot to that, all of that. And we kind of are getting into a lot of what your book is about. I mean, you've mentioned a lot of things that make me think of like no self, no problem, right? That's the title of your book. And I want to get to that, but I just want to define another thing here. You've mentioned a lot left and right brain. You've mentioned a little bit about the differences between them. But I'm curious to you, is this actually like a physical difference as well? Is there more activity going on in your left brain in certain activities and in your right brain? And what are some more of the differences and how can we define these things to kind of get a broader knowledge of what you're talking about here?
The whole left-right brain thing was a very interesting story in and of itself because, you know, it was 96. I had just finished a PhD in left-right brain differences. And that was almost at the point where psychology just wanted to throw the whole thing out. They were just so disgusted with the what they call pop psychology movement of everything was left-right brain and overgeneralizations, things like, well, the right brain's more creative, which actually it does seem like a lot of these things did turn out to be true. But the like saying something like the left brain's logical, I mean, that clearly is like just an oversimplification. But that all took a turn not that long ago. So we had Ian McGilchrist. He came up with The Master and His Emissary, which is this just unbelievable, you know, 800 pages of nothing but research on left-right brain differences. It was just like he was just going to, you know, make the facts so overwhelming that at the end you're an absolute believer that the left and right brain are so absolutely functionally different that they are worlds apart from each other. And I used to teach a class on this. And actually, we never got through anything more than chapter four, because it's a very, the research is so compelling. Because if you look at the neuroanatomy, well, I mean, if you even just look at the brain, you know, a kid will notice that there's a left and right side. I mean, it's one of the most obvious physiological differences. And so you ask, why did nature do that? You know, I mean, why not just one big brain? Well, actually, if you look through the whole nervous system, like we've got rods and cones in the eyes. We've got the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So the whole nervous system seems to be based on this complementary, you know, opposites. And so not you don't build one big system that does everything. You build two systems with specialization. And so we see that with the left and right sides of the brain, with neurotransmitters are different. The wiring is different, with the interconnectedness of the right brain far outweighing that of the left. But then when you get to the base, just the basics, like why did the left brain take language? And so in my book, it's really a very simplified version of exploring all these left-right brain differences. And what I did is I said, well, let's not get into all the detail, because it can be overwhelming. Let's just look at what really seems to have held up over time, and what the preponderance of research really seems to suggest. And so we know language is a big one, but that's not completely in the left brain. The majority of language is in the left brain. My ability to talk right now is controlled by Broca's area, which is in the left brain. But there are subtle things like the emotional tone of my language, and that's going to be the right brain. If I do some sarcasm, and or, you know, that's all the subtleties that the right brain is doing. But behind that is the left brain's ability of categorization. And to me, this is the real one of the things that stands out about the left brain, and how maybe it was 50,000 years ago, who knows, it was sometime in our history, where we were able to leave the real world and start living in these mental constructs, these thoughts about the real world rather than being in the world. And one of my favorite illustrations of this that captured it so perfectly was the movie. It's an old movie, 2001, Space Odyssey. And it's, you know, but it's that he shows our ancestors there, and there's, you know, they're at a resource, a water resource, but then they get bullied out of that. And then one of our ancestors looks at a bone and has maybe our first thought, because our ancestor was able to look at the bone but see it as a weapon. We were able to see the world for what it wasn't. So we were able to have that mental image of, you know, take the sensory information but transform it into something new. And of course it worked. And they were able to get the resource back. And then it was a beautiful image when he threw the bone into the air and it turned into a spaceship, because it's that same ability of mental transformation, which I call thinking. It's that same ability that is responsible for the technology we see today. But so when we get to categorization, again, with the left brain, it's another trick that is based on what the left brain does well, which is, again, focus on one thing at a time. And so when we categorize, there's all this, everything around us. We ignore almost all of it when we categorize. And we focus on one thing that many things have in common, and then we group them. Now, this is super useful. So my son's into soccer, and if you look out and you say, well, there's all kinds of differences in these kids. They're taller, they're shorter, a million, infinite differences. But some of them have green shirts on. And when I categorize, I can just take that one quality and say, well, they're just one team. And so it seems like an interesting trick. But of course, that's what language is. And so if I say the word dog, I'm taking an incredible variety of uniqueness, collapse, forgetting, ignoring all of that. And just taking a few little things that these animals have in common and putting them into one big group. Now that sounds like, well, maybe that's, you know, okay, a trick of categorization. Well, where does that get us into trouble? Well, in many ways, that's what the self is. You know, we take through the day this enormous range of variability in our behaviors, and we only focus on a couple things, and then we call this the self category, and we say, you know, I am this, you know, I'm extroverted or introvert, whatever. So we come up with our personality traits, but all those are just categorical differences. And again, categories are interesting because they rely on opposites. And so what would an introvert be without an extrovert? So all of our personality traits are really just a collection of, you know, opposing tendencies that we have. But the trick with these categories, and again, you could see, you know, people right now, politics is everywhere, and people are debating all the time about, and people will take all, you know, what do we have, three in the United States, was it 360 million people or something? And then we just collapse across every individual differences, billions of differences, and we say, well, Democrat and Republican. You know? I mean, it's a remarkable ability that the left brain has to ignore all the variability in the world and just focus on one thing and then contrast those. And so this usefulness of categories, so again, you see it in sports. I mean, it's very, you know, what would you do if they didn't all wear the same color? It would be really difficult to follow a team. But the important thing is to remember that team is in your head. And what I mean by that is it's a mental fiction. It's not real. And people say, well, okay, let's get into, well, what do you think is real? And reality is what can be consciously experienced. Direct conscious experiences are reality. And so you say, well, okay, let's just play a little bit with all these categories we have. And what you get is, it gets very, at least I find it very interesting, that all these categories we have in the world, particularly when we start arguing and debating about politics, none of them can be consciously experienced. And I'll tell people, I'll say, okay, let's play a game here. I want you to consciously experience a Democrat, not an example of a Democrat, just experience it. And you can't do it. It's very difficult because it's an abstract notion in your left brain. And you say, okay, what about the self? So let's get right down to what the self is. And I say, okay, right now I want you to consciously experience yourself in the same way. You can consciously, so, you know, if you've got some coffee or any basic conscious experience, and just dig it for a while and just experience it, and then say, okay, can I do that with the self? Can you see yourself? And you'll say, well, I can see my face in the mirror. Well, that's just an aspect of yourself. I don't want to, and it's not even necessary. People do have face transplants. You can do this. And so the face is not, you know, so let's get to the core. I want you to see yourself consciously. And people, at least when I talk and give this exercise, people realize they can't. Because the self isn't something that's existing in the real world. It's a concept. And we have a very difficult time of consciously experiencing concepts. So like justice, you can say, okay, consciously experience justice. And you might have an image in your mind of like someone robs a bank and then they go to jail. No, that's an example that in reality that you're fitting into this category. What I want you to do is directly experience justice. And people look and struggle with it for a while. And then they realize there's a big difference between the conscious things in my life, like, you know, jumping into a pool, you know, or tasting carrots, or, I mean, the smell of garlic. And these are all direct conscious experiences. And they have a real unique quality to them compared to our thoughts about them. And then all the thoughts that we've created, things like Democrats and Republicans, they didn't exist 50,000 years ago. These are thought creations, and most of these thought creations are very recent. So we probably invented the self again. All this happened kind of at once, some point in our past where we started talking, And then we started creating this idea of a self. And then this kind of exploded all these other abstract notions like governments and ownership. Ownership is one of my favorites. I've been doing so many videos on ownership because it's the weirdest thing in the world that we think someone owns something. Why did we buy into this? What in the world makes you convinced that you or anyone else in the world owns anything? You can't see ownership. You can't be conscious of it. It's nothing more than a collection of ideas that we put together, and we all agree that, you know, I own these guitars. Well, it's a nice social agreement, and I can pull it off as long as everyone in the world agrees with me. But the moment the rest of the world doesn't buy into that anymore, they could just come and take everything I've got because it's not real in the first place. I mean, control is real, and we see that through nature. So maybe there's some food and some resource, and a bigger bird comes along and takes that food. Well, that's control, and that's been around in nature for a long time. And what the left brain did is it turned that idea of control into the idea of ownership. And of course, isn't it interesting that to have ownership at all, you have to have a self? Because I own things. If there's no I, there's no one to own anything. And so what you see is with the left brain, particularly in the last couple hundred years, the left brain keeps creating these abstractions, and they're more and more bought into, and they're all tied in together into this abstract world of thinking, which is fine. The only problem with this abstract world of thinking is we're all terribly depressed in this world. We all think we have problems, and we're all really anxious because it's spinning futures that are really pessimistic. And to get out of that is to go back to simple conscious experiences, direct, clear conscious experiences. And all of a sudden, there's just so much joy and all these problems that we think we have, there's the realization that they were only problems that we thought we had. They're not real.
Right. They're basically just stories. And you called them abstractions, which is, I think, a good term as well. But there is some utility as well to these stories and these ideas, you know, the idea of ownership that serves the I that owns something, right? Can you just elaborate a little bit about that idea? Like, why do you think that we need these abstractions? What do they do for us?
That's a great, great, great question. Because when I go off on this, sometimes people think, well, what do you want to abolish the whole abstract? Let's just collapse the abstract world. And this has happened. And so I mentioned Ian McGilchrist a while back, and I forgot to mention Jill Bolte Taylor, but this is a great place to bring her up because she was a neuroanatomist. So she spent her whole life labeling and doing left brain things about the brain, and then had a massive left brain stroke. And the way she described her experience in My Stroke of Insight is that it was nirvana. Like when the left brain went offline, it was absolute what the Buddhists would call, you know, enlightenment. There's amazing joy and connectedness. And my favorite expression, she said, there's no place where I ended and the rest of the universe began. So she lost that categorical distinction between a separate I and the rest of the universe. And that brought about great bliss. But, you know, none of us would know that unless you went through rehab, which I think was very extensive, and regained the ability to engage in abstractions. And, you know, just the fact that we're, you know, using abstractions right now as pointers is a very, very useful thing. And even the idea of ownership. In fact, most of these abstractions, the left brain, they go back to a time when they were probably useful. I mean, you can look at, you know, countries that have constitutions, and these are all abstractions, but you could say, well, look, we've got a lot of people living together. It might be useful to, you know, put down some abstract rules that, to, you know, help things move along a little bit. And so that it's all just on the, way we treat it. You know, abstractions are an amazing servant, but they are a terrible master. And so they're useful as tools, but as I put in the books over and over again, you know, you have to ask, you know, am I using this as a tool or is it using me? And I think we got to the point where thoughts are using us a lot more than we are using them as useful abstractions. And it's true, ownership is a complete illusion, but there's a place where we could use it. And there's a place where it could serve a purpose. And you know, it could improve the way people work together. And it could improve a culture. But when we start, it's like taking a dream almost too seriously, or taking a joke. That's a better example, you know. I mean, we have all kinds of humor, and the right brain seems to be really tuned into humor because it gets context and the subtleties. But when you start taking everything very seriously, nothing is funny anymore. And so, you know, it's the same thing that's going on with humor. So you could say, you know, let's use these abstractions for what they are. And as long as we don't take them seriously, they won't come back to bite us.
Right. Yeah, it's about recognizing them. And it almost seems like it's a bit of a balance as well. And just a balance of understanding of what serves us and what doesn't. At least that's kind of my takeaway. I mean, it's a fascinating subject that I think is just good to think about, just consciously think about and explore. To me, at least, it's incredibly interesting. There's one thing I wanted to talk to you. I mean, we're coming up on an hour here, so I'll just ask you one more question here. Your subtitle of your book, I'm reading it here, is How Neuropsychology is Catching Up to Buddhism. What did you mean by that? And can you talk to me just a little bit about that?
Well, if you look at the Buddha and the teachings of the Buddha, and sometimes people think, well, you know, Buddhism as a religion, and then there's a secular form of Buddhism. And when I read the work of the Buddha, it's always just he was one of the first psychologists to me. You know, he had some amazingly, very insightful things that will help us today. But he had these things 2,500, and he had it 2,500 years ago without a lab, without, you know, he had no body of research he could go off of. But what he did was he used consciousness, direct conscious experiences, to pierce these illusions. And when it comes to the self, he did some, you know, I played around with these during our talk. You know, if there was this stable self, you know, could you observe it in any way? And when you use your conscious experience through the day, you realize the self is not stable at all. There's no consistency to the self. There's an amazing amount of variability. In fact, the self, when you start consciously becoming like focusing the spotlight of consciousness on what we think of as the thought of the self, it is in such change and in such flux that it's amazing we buy into the notion that there's any kind of stability to the self at all. You know, I forget who said this, but it's a definition of Buddhism, like everything changes. That's the simplest definition of Buddhism. And of course, if everything's changing, there is no stable self. And then the Buddha pointed out again, well, if there was this stable self, it should have some kind of volition, some kind of control. But when we look and when we consciously observe this notion of free will, and it doesn't seem to work. Because if I say, don't think of the number 13, well, let's put it this way. If the self, the way the Buddha put it, if the self was the way it appeared to be, we wouldn't all be deliriously happy, because we would never have an intrusive thought, because we would just choose not to have it. We would control our thoughts. And of course, if we wanted to be happy, we would be happy. And so the very fact that we don't control our thoughts, the fact that there is no stability to the self, just shows through this illusion. And the reason the title came up is because it's taken us 2,500 years as neuroscientists, and the work of, like, you know, Benjamin Libet, and this, you know, figuring out that free will is an illusion, and neuroscientists digging. And I just did a video on my YouTube about there is no self in the brain. Neuroscientists have been looking for it. They can't find it. Now, there's two options here, because they can find some cells that might respond to thoughts about the self. But that says, okay, well, then you're a bunch of neurons in the brain. And that doesn't feel very like the idea, like, oh, who are you? Oh, I'm a bunch of neurons that activate when I think about who I am. That's not very satisfying. I mean, what so the neuroscientists can't find the self that we think of as the self, you know, the satisfying self, the one that's like stable, consistent, and has control over the world, or at least our little piece of it. And so it really has taken psychology and neuroscience, you know, 2,500 years to catch up with these insights that this guy who, you know, went into deep, deep meditation and had insights based on conscious observation of what was going on. And so, yeah, that was, I mean, the book goes into, you know, in fact, at the very end, I really enjoy playing with some non-dualistic ideas. Because I find when the self is questioned by conscious experience, and there's this realization that the self is only what I thought it was, there's nothing really behind it, all of a sudden consciousness starts to expand, and it becomes much more than what we think it is. And so once the self is gone, you'll see a significant change in consciousness. It doesn't, and I'm going to get a little mystical here, but it doesn't seem to be localized in the skull the way we think it is. And so this is the mystical experiences that so many people have talked about. And these mystical experiences happen more and more the less and less you rely on thinking.
Yeah, and it's a difficult experience to describe because we have to tell a story about it, and it is something to be experienced. But you know, we say like those experiences are, you know, connecting to much more than us, right? You said the consciousness is expanding beyond what you previously had as a consciousness, and you can kind of be, yeah, once again, more connected to many, many things and not just one. So it's interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned non-dualism there and exploring that in your book. And I think, yeah, if anybody wants to just continue on with some of these topics, I think your book, No Self, No Problem, which is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Audible, that's probably a good place to start. And then did you have anywhere else where you wanted to direct the listener, Chris?
Just if you want to explore some strangeness, weirdness, things that are, you know, outside the typical way of thinking, check out my YouTube channel. It's just Chris Niebuhr, PhD. And I explore, that's a place where I put very little limits on how weird it gets. So
I love it. Yeah. And all those links will be in the description. And yeah, just thanks for the very interesting conversation, Chris.
Oh, thanks, Forrest. It was super cool. I couldn't believe an hour has passed. That's great. Time definitely is an illusion.